Welcome to Sounds from Silence, a series of conversations with composers about their sources for inspiration and what lights their creative spark. I'm Sydney Chen, and in this episode, I speak with Lithuanian-born and New York-based composer Žibuoklė Martinaitytė, whose recent choral work titled Alethea is about to receive its first U.S. performances. We spoke about music making as an act of resistance and truth-telling, how the mind perceives the passage of time, and the importance of nature in our lives. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Hi, Žibuoklė. Thanks for joining us here on Sounds from Silence.
Thank you so much for having me here. And I really love the title of your podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
It was really about the idea of how do you get from nothing to something? And that's the ultimate question that I have for composers is how do you make something when nothing was there to begin with? So that's where the title came from.
Yeah, that's our everyday struggle, right? As a composer, as a creative people, is how to make something out of nothing. But that nothing seems to be very potent with a lot of potential, right? You could make pretty much anything at any given moment. You just have to be very open and you have to be a well-tuned instrument, I think. Mm-hmm. As a performers, let's say, they have to practice every day, right? To be able to play at this highest level of their skill. And I think the same is for composers. It's not so much that you have to compose every day, but somehow your mindset, your framework has to be very subtly nuanced so mm-hmm. that you would be able to perceive everything in this kind of musical way. And anything could be musical. I mean, even like walk in a park could be musical. Or I used to compose in my head while I was swimming. I was swimming every day. So a lot of music was born in that YMCA swimming pool in New York City.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And then, yeah, if they would only know how I used my time there.
That's fantastic.
Yes.
Well, we're talking today because you have recently written a piece that was premiered by the Latvian Radio Choir in Kaunas, Lithuania for a festival called Baltic Music Days. And this got premiered in November 2022, and the piece is titled Alethea, which is now about to receive its first U.S. performance by a group called Volti in the San Francisco Bay Area, and that's happening. We're recording on May 8th, and the performances are happening this weekend, May 13th and 14th. And so I just wanted to talk to you about this piece and the inspiration behind it, how you moved through the process of composing it, and just the circumstances around which it was written. So I think maybe let's first start talking about the title.
It's a Greek word. I haven't studied Greek. I studied Latin at some point, but not Greek. And I managed to choose titles for my pieces that are sometimes coming from very strange languages, and I cannot even pronounce them myself, but I do that not on purpose. It's just there's this saying that we don't choose who to love, and we don't choose who loves us back. So it's the same with my choice of ideas or concepts for new pieces. Mm. So let's say I'm reading some book and then all of a sudden I see some word that immediately illuminates some kind of new set of meaning and like opening the door to a new perception that some angle that I never thought about, right? Mm. And then I'm thinking, wow, that's wonderful. It works like a key. So it opens the door and then I'm there in a new perception, in a new room. And I don't need any stimulants for that. It's just a word that triggers that, right? So whenever I have that feeling of inspiration, especially when I'm reading, then I write it down. I write down the word, I write down the meaning, and that's how a lot of my pieces come about. So in this case, Alethea, that word I met for the first time in a Lewis Hyde book called A Primer for Forgetting. It's really beautiful book and has a lot of rich material, poetic material, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think from that very book I stole, let's call it stealing, because artists always do that. You know, we just, right. Well, maybe not stealing, but repurposing. You know, you find something and then you recontextualize, repurpose it and add some new meanings to it. Or mm-hmm. So from that very book, it's already second piece that came from that book.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, so aletheia, lethes is a Greek word that stands for forgetfulness, mm-hmm. something that remains hidden, something that is covered. And then the negative term of that same word is aletheia, which means truth, or something that is being revealed, something that is being opened up in front of our eyes, something that was previously hidden. Mm. How it came about was, you know, I had that commission for the Latvian radio choir, was thinking what to do with it. And then the war in Ukraine started. Mm. And because I'm originally from Lithuania, so it's very close to home. Yeah. And we all have been under oppression of Russia. So we know what it feels like and we know how painful it can get. And I had very... unusual response to that war, because for a while I was creatively paralyzed because it felt so meaningless, you know, to do any creative act when people are dying, innocent people. Yeah. And then at some point after like a few weeks, I thought, well, I still have to compose because that's my way of life. And this is how I fight the war, by saying that life exists and it continues and we find the meaning despite of the war. So the title aletheia was that kind of revelation where you see the war breaking out, which you didn't expect to happen. So all of a sudden, the truth of the political world, of all the things that were hidden from us, all of a sudden became very obvious. The intentions of that big country and ambitions and how they like to live in the complete, I don't know, in some manufactured reality that they present to their people. So that idea of uncovering the truth was important to me when I was composing the piece. And the very first musical impulse was a little bit weird, I would say, because all of a sudden I heard in my mind screaming of or shouting of people, kind of, it was weeping but screaming at the same time. And it was the kind of in a downward scale and multiple voices. And then it was like a oral hallucination, or maybe it even came in a dream, that musical moment. Of course, I didn't know where I'm going to place it in a piece, but it ended up somewhere in a climactic part of the piece. That scream, not scream, but you know, those multiple downward motifs, mm-hmm. in multiple voices. And then also I was thinking that voice is our very first instrument in this life that we have. So when we come, right, babies immediately scream and they show their voices very clearly. And then at the end of our lives, we also end up with this last, maybe last words or a last sigh or last whisper. Yeah. So a voice as a kind of as a sacred instrument that we always carry within ourselves. It tells so much information, even without singing, even without speaking, you know, just the quality of voice itself. Also, I was imagining that in a situation of war where people are fighting and there are explosions and fires and all those noises, very loud noises, people have, they don't have musical instruments, right? In the field, in the battlefield. But what they have is their voices. So if they want to express themselves, some kind of emotion that is stirring up within them, they could use their voice, they could shout, they could, well, they could sing also if they wanted to, if because singing makes people feel more unified, right, as a group. So you feel that power that is rising. And I remember also those times of my teenage years when Lithuania became independent country from Soviet Union. And what was happening in those days, it was so-called singing revolution in the Baltic states, right? Mm-hmm. So Russians were attacking us with tanks and weapons, and people, our people were just singing back to them as a gesture of their strength, as an expression of their freedom. And if you wanna, you could kill us, but we will be singing till the very last moment. I mean, I witnessed some of the scenes, of course, live as a teenager, and that also left a very strong impression on me. And I think all those ideas that I just talked about, they ended up being in a piece, Alethea.
So the section that you mentioned with the descending motif, it's so powerful. And I think we'll include an excerpt of that in this program in a little bit. I was curious to know, you mentioned the singing revolution, and this piece was premiered in a Baltic music festival that was a collaboration between Lithuania and Estonia and Latvia, as I understand it. And it was premiered by the Latvian radio choir. And I'm just wondering if you had the sense that those singers were also engaging with this shared history in the performance of the piece. Did you talk about that at all? Did that inform the premiere performance?
I think, yes, absolutely. Of course, it connected us all, that shared history, but we were not speaking about it. We were not verbalizing.
Right.
I think many things are understood kind of contextually. So we didn't have to talk about it. Because when I was surprised when Latvian radio choir sent me the recording of their first reading of the piece, you know, just the first draft, so to say. And I immediately felt like they get it. They understand what this piece is about. I don't have to explain myself.
Can you tell us a little bit about the structure of the piece itself? Let's contextualize it for the listeners. How long is it? What forces is it for? How is the piece built?
I think it's about a 15-minute piece. Could be longer or shorter, depending. There's some freedom that the conductor can allow themselves to either expand or subtract time a little bit. And because I was writing for such a choir as the Latvian radio choir, as we know, it's one of the best choirs in Europe, that's for sure. So I knew that I could write anything I want to for them. And that inspired me to have more divisions in the voices. Mm-hmm. So let's say instead of 4 or 8 divisions of the group, I have 16 voices. Mm. But then I have to reveal a secret here. When I heard Volti San Francisco concert in 2020, Mark Vinges, composer, presented a piece. I think it was also divided into 16 or 20 voices. I think it was 16. And I thought, that's just brilliant piece. And next time I'm going to write 16 voices too, or more.
Oh, that's fantastic.
So in a way it was Mark who put me on track.
That's such a great connection, because I actually spoke to Mark in the first episode of this podcast. And one of my questions for him is, what do you hope that other creators might take away from hearing works of yours? And you just never know, right? You never know what aspect of your work someone might internalize and be inspired by. So I love hearing that.
And I think we all love when other people are inspired by our creative output, and also even take some ideas and use them for their own. Because if you can ignite imagination of another human being, that's a high goal of any art form, right?
I think it's kind of magical.
It's kind of magical.
One of the special things about working with creative artists is seeing how many unexpected things can be elicited from people who interact with the art that's being created. I came across an interesting comment you made in an interview that I was reading. I think you were talking about a concerto, and you were talking about how there are certain expectations of the soloist, and how you would prefer to see the soloist as like one tree among many, or something along those lines. Within this piece, there's a lot of ensemble singing, but then there are also solo lines. And I just wanted to hear how you think about those lines emerging from the texture and the relationship of the solo singers to the rest of the group.
Well, in my music, what usually takes place is a lot of layering of sounds, right? And for the layering, I need multiple lines. So the more lines I have, the more interesting texture it becomes. Mm-hmm. And then the more I have a freedom to kind of play within that texture and to achieve more colors. But if you single out some soloist, then it's very clearly defined role of what is happening. So one is one against many. And as you said, this metaphor of a forest with multiple trees, it's true, I mean, for my music. And also, I like that experience myself in reality too, you know, being in a forest, and then it's completely magical because it's a multiplicity of the same objects, but they are all slightly different and they are all slightly individualized. And if you pay attention to any of them, or if you focus on them, mm-hmm. you single them out, like one voice out of many, then all of a sudden it reveals all its beauty, or it reveals something that you haven't seen before, some symmetry or some amazing shape or color. So the same happens with those individualized lines in the choral work. So all voices function as one texture, but then every voice is equally important. So if one of them is thinking that, oh, I just have a few notes to sing and then the others are more important, it's not true at all, because it's a composite that matters. It's this myriad of details that from those details you see some other sonic image arising. And of course, voices create harmony, right? So the more voices, the thicker the harmony can be and thicker the chords could be.
So let's actually take a pause here and let's listen to a little bit of Evlathia so that we can get a sense of this mesmerizing and really powerful piece that Žibuoklė has written. This is performed by the Latvian Radio Choir. The piece was commissioned by LRT Klasika and recorded live by the Lithuanian National Radio in Kaunas, Lithuania in November 2022.
Yeah.
So we've been listening to an excerpt from a recording of Aletheia sung by the Latvian radio choir. And one thing that we didn't talk about in the first half is about the use of just vowels and consonants and not text in this work to express emotion, express musical ideas. And I was just wondering what relationship you have to those vowel sounds and also to text in general.
It sounds like a simple question, but it's not simple at all. It's true that in all my choral works, I'm not using text. Even though I love poetry and I love books and I read a lot in both languages, in English and in Lithuanian, but somehow when it comes to taking some text and setting it to music, I get, I don't know how to deal with it. I get frightened a little bit because it seems like putting constraints on myself, because the language in itself, it has music, right? So the poetry already suggests some kind of intonation or some, not even its meaning, but the words themselves, they have music in them.
Yes.
And then I can't imagine how to deal with that relationship, with that inherent music that is in the text, and then how to make it work for my musical expression. So that's why I find it very liberating to use vowels and syllables that I create myself. In a way, it's not only freedom, but also it creates a quite different effect, because voices sound more like instruments. In that case, because when you listen to them sing something that doesn't have a literary meaning, then you can freely associate and create your own images in your head from that music, and you don't have to wait till the next word. What is it going to be, and what is the meaning, and what if you don't hear it, and what if it's not pronounced correctly? And then there are all those mental tasks that we put even on the listeners, you know, while listening to the text. I mean, it's true with opera too, you know. You have to know the lyrics, you have to understand the meaning, otherwise you lose a lot in perceiving the artwork. But also there's another aspect that is more philosophical, I think. A lot of spiritual traditions are using vowel singing to induce some kind of a state of mind.
Yes.
To help mind to reach this deeper meditative state and to calm down our brain waves. Mm-hmm. And it helps. And also, you know, by changing vowels, the mere fact of the change creates different harmonic overtones of the pitch that we hear, which means it creates this richness of harmonic color, you know, mm-hmm. that a listener doesn't have to understand what is happening, but they would have the experience that it's some kind of throat singing or something like that.
Well, there was something that I read in another one of the interviews that I came across. You made a comment about observing small changes in sound, in timbre, in vowels, and the changes were constant, that there was constant movement and shifts. And when I was reading it, the immediate association that I had was with Vipassana meditation and just this observation that change is constant in the sitting process. And it was only after that that I learned that you have a longstanding meditation practice and study of Buddhism. And so I'm curious to know how that aspect of your observation of the mind and its processes, how that influences your work. It seems to be so deeply intermeshed. And I'm curious if you think about it that way.
It happens almost without my conscious decision, you know, like I don't want to integrate my meditation practice or whatever I'm doing there and how I work with my mind in the formalized meditation practice. I don't want to try to put it into music, but somehow it finds its way, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's the same mind that is meditating, that's the same mind that is creating music later on. I mean, we cannot escape ourselves. So all the practice, all the experiences in that meditation practice, they sneak in into music. And I think somehow subconsciously almost, I'm looking for those experiences in the music. So if music is able to produce some kind of a concentrative meditative state of mind, then I think I succeeded. You know, but it's only for me. I don't know if it translates to other listeners, but I think from what I've heard, some feedback from the listeners, that they also get to some kind of different states of minds, and even performers too. I mean, I don't know if it's true for singers, but some instrumentalists have told me that they completely had almost out of the body experience when playing my music. They said, we forgot about time. We forgot what was happening. It was absolutely a clear space of awareness, just pure perception, and that's it. And I think half a year ago, I don't remember in connection to what premiere it was written, but I think one reviewer who attended the concert, they noted that I cannot speak objectively about her piece because it put me into such a deep place that I forgot about everything. And I don't know what happened there. I cannot objectively write about it. But I was shocked because I was thinking, how could you do that? You are a reviewer. You are getting paid for, you know, finding words to verbalize your experience. But I guess that reviewer was so taken by the music that, you know, couldn't do it.
That's astonishing.
I think it was orchestral piece. Yes, I've one of my orchestral pieces. Yeah.
That's such a wonderful response to get from a listener, for someone who is experiencing your work. I have noticed that there is an expansiveness of time that exists in your work, that the scope of time feels different in your work than in pieces that are more event-driven or are constantly looking for more obvious change. And I'm wondering how you think about time within the compositional process. Do you create an architecture of time that you are trying to navigate through? Do you look for milestones? How is it that you structure time as you're composing?
I have maps of time, let's call them that. And that's one of the early stages of composing the pieces. So I map out all the acoustic events that will be happening, or some kind of a journey in time, like how I imagine, where am I going, and do I go up or down, or do I stand still, or do I want to accelerate the time? So it's how I'm going to treat time in this particular, let's say 10 or 15 or 20 minutes, right? But those are only departing points. And then once I start composing, once I have found the material that I will be working with, the material itself dictates some kind of natural flow of time, which doesn't always fit into my maps that are so beautifully drawn and with multiple colors sometimes and all kinds of descriptive things. But I think it's just stages of composition that you have to go through. We as a composers, we have tools and we have knowledge of how to suspend time and how to accelerate time. Sometimes we are doing it on a rational side, and sometimes it happens by itself. If I write shorter pieces, I would like to have the experience of longer time. So I would like to suspend time. Now, if I have a long piece, like an hour long piece, I don't want people to think that it's too long or it's too boring. So then what you need to do is to accelerate time a little bit so that the experience would flow somewhat faster. So the perception of the experience would be much faster. And for that, you need less changes. Music works the same way as our memory. So let's say in our memory, if nothing happens, if it's just daily life without any events, it seems like the time flies by very quickly. In the memory, we don't remember that period of time if nothing happened. If some significant event happens, or multiple significant events, it fills the memory with like the experience of time that was very rich. So it seems like it was a longer time after all. Let's say after 20 years or 30 years, if we think back, then all those years of childhood, it seemed like nothing happened for years, right? And then grandmother died, okay, event. And then you remember that point in time, the reference point. So the same applies to music, because music is partly built from our memory, right? And as a listener, we also have to engage our memory in order to perceive the musical composition. because our shorter memory has to be present from the beginning to the end so that we would understand what kind of shape or what kind of journey we experience. And then some things that we heard at the beginning, they start making sense later because you see all the connections between some musical gestures that are being revealed to you through the music. As a composer, I think about those things and I think like what type of experience of time I want to give to my listener. So, as I said, in my longer pieces...
The Cadal Zone, for example, which is a piece that just received its U.S. premiere, I think, this past weekend, right?
Yeah, it was the U.S. premiere took place on Saturday, May 6th, at the Long Play Festival organized by Bank on a Can in New York. And it was an hour and 5 minutes long piece.
Performed by the Lithuanian group called
Synesthesis.
And it also includes some vocal samples from the same group, Volti, and also a very well-known bass singer named Eric Alatorre.
In that piece, it's a longer form, and the time flows much faster. So that hour, 1 hour, goes just like, time goes very fast somehow.
So since we're coming towards the end of our time, I don't want to leave it without talking a little bit about nature. And Hadal Zone, the images are drawn from the deep ocean, the term itself. Hadal Zone is an oceanographic term. And I know that you have a deep relationship with nature and that it feeds your creativity. You have a composing studio in Lithuania that's in nature. And your name also in Lithuanian, is a type of a flower. And so I just wanted to hear how you think nature feeds your creative spirit, especially as somebody who has been living in an urban environment for such a long time.
That's true. I've been born into urban environment and living in big cities usually. But I always go to nature, especially for my concentrated composing periods. And I can't imagine my life without it. In nature, somehow, I don't know, purifies everything. All what is in your mind just settles down, and then you can see all the simplicity of life, but at the same time, all the complex nature of it, you know? So if you are not engaged in your own mental chatter when you walk through the forest or when you are facing the infinity of the ocean, then at some point everything calms down and then you can observe the waves forever. And then you find it fascinating, even for hours. You could sit there for an hour or two and it never gets boring somehow. And it's always enough information and you never feel like something is missing. Right? So which tells you that it contains all what we need, basically. So I kind of like that, to go back to that essential state of us as human beings that is not distorted by technology, you know, because we get our sense of self is so mirrored back to us and then it becomes such a distortion. We don't even know how to perceive everything, let alone ourselves. But nature somehow helps us to get back to our roots, to this essential thing, what it means to be a human being. And then from that place, from that simplicity and from that depth, you can create works that resonate with others, because on that level, we are all connected. On that level, we are all I'm not saying that we are all the same. Of course, we are all different. But on that level, we understand one another, you know, because it's very universal to all of us.
Just to wrap things up here, one thing that I've noticed about all creative artists is that nobody is operating solely within their field, right? They're always reading, as you said, or looking at visual art. And I know that you have been inspired by all sorts of things that are outside of music, as well as within music, of course. But I'm just wondering if you have a recommendation of anything that you've seen or heard or listened to or experienced lately that you would want to share with other people, or you think that other people should experience as well.
I will start with music, maybe.
Okay.
So the latest very unforgettable experience was seeing online, actually, opera by Finnish composer Kaija Saariaho called Innocence, which is based on a very heartbreaking topic concerning the school shootings. And it's really intense work. I mean, it really creates this never-ending anxious intensity that lasts for 2 hours. And the opera is being sung in different languages, so you have to watch subtitles because otherwise you don't understand the meaning. But it's so engaging, but it also thought-provoking, and it really helps to process all those things that are happening in our country, you know. So I found it very powerful. And, you know, Kaija Saariaho is not young anymore. She's in her, late 70s, I think, or even 80s maybe. And to compose such a powerful work in that age, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's really mind-blowing how she could do it, and how could she even live with that subject matter for, I don't know, for the year or two when she was composing that opera.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sibokle. You can hear the piece that we've been talking about, Alethea, performed by Volti on their performances in May. This is the U.S. premiere of the piece. There are two performances on May 13th in Walnut Creek and May 14th in San Francisco. The Volti program is titled Sounds and Shadows. There are five pieces on the program. In addition to Sibokle's work, there's a world premiere of Mark Wingus's Words Cast Shadows, and we spoke about that on the first episode of this podcast. And there are also pieces by Trevor Weston, Carolyn Shaw, and Eric Tuan. We've been talking with Sibokle Martin-Aitite. Thank you so much for joining us here today. It's been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Sid, so much for having me on your show.
It's really my pleasure. We'll put a bunch of links in the show notes. My name is Sydney Chen, and thanks again for listening to Sounds from Silence.